this morning's speaker is Gunnar Carlson. He's from Stanford University, and he's going to tell us about the shape of data. He's a topologist from the mathematics department.
Thank you for the invitation. Let me say, this talk isn't maybe as focused in exactly the area of this meeting, but my experience has always been that physicists are interested in everything, so hopefully it will be of interest. There will certainly be some things in cancer and so on. So let me talk about the message. First of all, data has shape. So what do you mean by that? Well, data, if you think of a microarray, for example, it comes as a collection of vectors. It has a notion of distance on it. There could be Euclidean distance. It could be some kind of correlation distance. Actually, there are many choices. And notion of distance is really what we mean when we say a notion of shape. And then what I also want to say is that the shape of the data actually matters. It's important what the shape is and what the overall organization of the data is. For example, a very common kind of aspect of shape, the most rudimentary, elementary aspect of shape, is does it break up into connected pieces? Right, so that's a clustering situation which we're all familiar with. On the other hand, I could look at a predator-prey model like this, where if I had actual observed data, I would see that that data actually took, it doesn't cluster, it's all connected, but due to the periodic or recurrent nature of the phenomenon, the data goes around some kind of loop. And another aspect of the shape might be a data set which looks like this, where what you can see is happening is there's actually sort of maybe a central area here, and then three flares going out in different directions, which describe sort of extreme points at the end of those flares. Understanding that those aspects of the shape of the data is probably something that one wants to do right away. It's the first thing that you want to do when you look at your data before trying to model it too much. So what's the shape normally defined in terms of the distance metric? Again, I mentioned Euclidean correlation distances, but you might even think of sort of notions of distance and similarity coming out of blast scores of sequences, Hamming distances when you have discrete data, and so forth. So it encodes similarity. Typically in data, when we attach a metric to it, what we're saying is if the distance is small, we want that to encode the fact that the data points are somehow similar from our point of view. So what is topology? Topology is a formalism that was developed over the last 400 years, say, and it has two goals: to measure and to represent notions of shape. So, and we'll talk more about that in a second, but this has been part of pure mathematics since the 1700s. In fact, Euler was sort of the first to get involved in that. But what's happened in the last 10 years is that ideas from topology have actually been moved from the realm of kind of completely defined spaces that are defined by combinatorial finite descriptions to instead dealing with point clouds, by which we mean finite metric spaces of collections of points with a notion of distance. So yeah, this was Euler's original problem here, where he was trying to ask, can you do a circuit here going over every bridge exactly once? All right, so what are the three aspects of topology? After all, you could say, well, shape, I mean, there's notions of curvature, for example, and so on, that are sort of not part of topology. Let me say what the three key ideas are. First one is coordinate freeness. That is to say, the properties that you study topologically should not depend on your particular choice of coordinates. Now, if you're thinking about the data world, that's an important thing. Imagine, for example, that you're doing microarray studies of the same phenomena, but on different platforms or in different labs or with different assumptions. You might believe that you should be capturing the same underlying phenomenon, that the shape of it should be the same. However, you can't necessarily compare them because of the difference in the platforms, the choices of genes, and so on that are made. Similarly, there's a notion of invariance under deformation. That is to say, there are properties that don't change when you stretch the metric space or the point cloud, but you're not allowed to tear it. And finally, compressed representation. So one of the big themes in the first half of the 20th century was representing spaces by, you know, unions of triangles, tetrahedra, and so on, combinatorial ways, asking, is the combinatorics of a simplicial complex, is it determined in some sense by the topology, and vice versa. So, of course, a simplicial complex is just a finite list of points and edges and triangles and so on. So it is a very compressed representation of what is an infinite amount of information in your space, which is infinitely many points and infinitely many measurements of distance. So coordinate freeness here says this. It says, you know, maybe you see it as a circle, maybe it looks as a, maybe it sits as a circle in three-dimensional space, but tilted a little bit. Invariance to deformations is important for a lot of tasks, but in particular, the one people are quite able to do it very effectively, in that we can recognize the fact that we've got a topological letter A there on the left. We can see that no matter what the font is, we can recognize the A from the B. That's really a topological property. And another one here is, if you had a circle in the plane, but you happened to do a log-log transform on it, you would see it as not a circle any longer, but something that's been kind of deformed a little bit, but nevertheless it has the loopy behavior to it. And finally, the compressed representations of geometries, and here I'm giving you the simplest version of that. You have a circle, it gets can be represented very easily by a list of 6 points and 6 edges, together with the incidence relations among those. Okay, so from topology, again, I will repeat, we got the two tasks. We want to represent shape, and we want to somehow measure shape. We want to have some, non-subjective way of describing and measuring shape. Okay, so here's the question. The question then is, what I'm going to show you today is basically two themes, the two themes of the measurement and the representation of shapes extended from the world of spaces to the world of point clouds. So let me give you an idea here of a very simple way of going from shape to combinatorics. There's a circle, and what you can see is that it's covered by three sets. It's covered by the red, the yellow, and the blue. The blue consists of two pieces, and then the overlaps here are the purples, as you see, and the greens. So one way of doing a topological mapping or creating a complex out of this covering is to say the following. I'm going to create a node for every connected component of every one of these sets that appear. And then what I'm going to do is I'm going to draw an edge between any set in, or any node that represents a set which intersects with another one. So in this case, for example, the blue intersects with the red, the blue intersects with the yellow. So what I will do is I will fill in edges like that. And you can see that what I've done is I've actually reconstructed that circle, at least, topologically. Well, we've lost the curvature information, but we've retained the information that there's a loop in the data. Okay. So now suppose you're given a point cloud data set instead of that actual honest circle. You can build simplicial complexes the same way if you have a covering. So the key object here is a covering, and you choose the covering, you build a node for every set in the covering,
What is a simplicial complex?
Simplicial complex. Simplicial complex is a description of a space as being built up of a union of nodes, edges, triangles, tetrahedra, and then higher dimensional analogs. So it's entirely combinatorial. So for example, the representation...
Like triangulation of a surface.
Exactly. So triangulation, that was what I called representation data, really was the whole theme of triangulation, which happened in the first half. Yeah.
You say again what covering is?
Oh, so a covering of a set is just a collection of sets whose union is all of it. So let's go back to this one. So here, what I have is three sets. I have sort of the red, or a red arc, and it includes the purple because that's an intersection. I have two blue arcs, and I have a yellow arc. And their union is the circle, but they overlap. So in other words, it's not like, you know, if you think about clustering divides a space up into disjoint pieces. A covering doesn't require that you divide it up into disjoint pieces. In fact, what you do is you leverage, you use the fact that there are intersections to retain some of the geometry. So here, that's what we're doing. We're saying, look, given that geometry, you know, here, this would be the clustering, so to speak. And now I'm saying, look, but let's retain the geometry, and then we know that some of these intersected, so we'll fill in edges where they intersected. Notice, by the way, that I did not draw an edge this way to that way, because these two don't intersect. So, but the key idea is then just that all you need is a set and a collection of sets which cover it, and you can build one of these constructions.
So they could have intersected if you defined them differently, right?
Absolutely. So I might have had, for example, imagine that we have the following situation. You know, so suppose I cover it like this, and I cover it like this. So I've got this set, and I've got this set. Then what I would have is I would draw two nodes and a single edge between them. So in that case, I would lose the the topology. So I don't mean to suggest that any covering that you choose will accurately represent the topology. There are actually theoretical conditions that say when you do and when you don't. But the point is, it is a way of taking the geometric object and extracting from it in a sort of automatic or systematic way a combinatorial object.
Since in every case you're losing information, mm-hmm. right? You have to do this for some value, right?
What's the value of the covering?
That's right. What do you gain by representing it in a different way like that?
Well, you gain the smallness of representation. Like the fact that you know, your data set may have tens of thousands of points, but maybe you've represented it by 10 points and their 10 nodes and their interaction. I'm going to tell you here how we systematically do this. So it's not, you know, obviously what I've told you so far is extremely general.
Just the last question. Is there a way to understand some kind of dimension of the representation so that you know that the covering is sufficient?
Right. I would say it's not so much the dimension, but here's what it might be. So, for example, suppose that you had a covering, and then you went back and you asked yourself, well, what's the diameter of each set in the covering? Suppose that you find that diameter is quite small. In other words, then you're starting to believe that your representation is accurate. On the other hand, you may have coverings where actually they aren't small, and then what you're getting, you're not getting an accurate representation of the space itself, you're getting a map from your space to some reference space. And it won't be a totally accurate representation, but nevertheless it will often carry information, even that. So, you know, the idea of coordinatization is an important one, but sometimes even something which, you know, gives you a partial coordinatization is useful.
But then you have a metric already. You have in mind a metric for a distance?
Exactly. So the starting point for us, the input to this machine, is going to be a finite metric space. Come to the point. So how do you choose the coverings? After all, there are many, many ways of choosing coverings of space. So here's one way. And I'm going to break it up into two pieces. And when I tell you the first one, you're going to say, you still haven't reduced the problem for me, but I have. So when I show you the second one. So the idea is this. Given a reference map to some familiar space, like the real line, like the circle, like a tree, like the plane, where you have good families of coverings. So let me talk about that for a second. So the real line, for example, has a very nice collection of coverings that I can parameterize by, you know, the length of the intervals and the percent overlap. So, for example, I could do this, where all of these have length L. And this is some fixed percentage P. That's a nice, simple family of coverings on this real line. And I can propagate that up to, you know, to a rectangular array where I have boxes. I can do the same thing for the circle, and trees have their own notions. So I have, in other words, I have a reference space for which I have a well-understood family of coverings. If I then have a reference map from my metric space to this space or to the plane or whatever, I can pull back and take the inverse image of these elements of the cover. And it gives me what I would call a binning of the data set. That is to say, it divides it up into bins. Overlapping bins, by the way. Notice the coverings here overlap. Right, so So here's the picture. You can see here's the reference map. The intervals are red and blue and so on, and this gives the bending here. These are actually, you can't tell that these are purple. And so what this does is this takes this point cloud and replaces it with this much more compressed, smaller point cloud.
So this is FF inverse, right? You go to the line, and then you go from the line back into...
Correct. But in the line, I select one of these intervals and take the bin.
And then you end up with the network.
That's correct. Notice what I've done, though. I had to take clustering within the bins. So the workflow is like this. You take your reference map, you produce the bins. Now you apply your favorite clustering scheme within each of those bins. So you produce what I would call local clusters. So here, this bin, for example, has two local clusters in it, and you see the two local clusters here. And so what you can then do is now you ask yourself, well, do the local clusters overlap, and I can build the edges like that.
So the projection doesn't matter in that case. If you're projecting it along the vertical line, you still have recognized the clusters?
Well, yeah, I may have had a little problem here because, you know, it's not quite spread out enough. In other words, I might have had to go take much finer intervals to get the right level of resolution. But yes, in this case, I would have.
Are you suggesting there's an objective way to produce a network on the right from a data set plus the data set on the left? Beyond, just eyeballing it and putting little circles.
I am, yes, that's correct. Yeah. In fact, so the second point I'm going
to
say...
There's an arbitrary aspect to this, right? I mean, I could have imagined that I take the middle blues and purples, right? I could imagine that I would want to make two dots, blue dots out of that by...
Here?
Yeah. Well, by two. So it's an arbitrary aspect to recover it.
Here's what I would say. I wouldn't call it arbitrary. I would say it is subject to inputs. So indeed, there are inputs here. What is the input? One input is the choice of covering of your reference space. Another is your reference map. A third is the clustering scheme internal to the bins, which is what I think Arnie's talking about. But once you specify those things, then it is a system for generating it automatically. Yeah. Yes.
Maybe another way of posing the question is that, as you said, there's the question of resolution.
Exactly right.
I could have chosen smaller number of these intervals,
yep.
And that would have arrived at a different, right, sort of
correct.
Coarser, so with fewer nodes,
correct.
Compressed representation, or I can really make lots of nodes there, right?
Exactly. So, and let me make
a... Decide objectively.
I'm sorry, what?
How does one decide objectively?
Okay, so this is going to actually be the part that comes into the second part of the talk, which is that it's better not to decide objectively, but to keep track of the whole profile. So, in fact, here what you do, you can say here that if I choose something at lower resolution, there's a map from the higher resolution to the lower resolution. And sometimes some of these things might collapse. But that whole philosophy of viewing things across maps as well as objects by their own, you know, is called functoriality and is actually, you know, a fundamental idea within topology, and I hope to argue for understanding shape in this context as well.
That's just a naive question.
Yeah.
So why the right, there seems like two right clusters in the left map, right? But then they merge into one right node in the right. So how did this happen?
I'm sorry, which part?
On the tail part.
Out here?
Why not two red dots?
Yeah, why not
two red dots at the end?
No, in the middle.
Here.
Yeah.
Well, the clustering scheme actually saw these as close together enough. I mean, this is depending on what clustering scheme you chose. So, you know, what we would typically do here is choose, single linkage clustering with a choice of parameter depending on certain hypotheses. So what are the maps or the filters to the reference space? And so one thing that you might do is you might take the result of some density estimator or some proxy for density. Others would be measures of so-called data depth or centrality. That is to say, how far are you from the middle of the data set? That turns out to be a very useful one. Fancier things like this, you could, there are certain eigenfunctions of certain networks attached to the data set that you could use. You could, if you like, if you have a data set that's coming in matrix form, you could use a PCA or a multidimensional scaling coordinates as your coordinates or as your filter. And finally, if you have knowledge about your data set, then you might very well be interested in the behavior of certain specific choices of function on it that come from your knowledge. Yeah.
Measures of data depth again.
Yes, so
it's not important. Then don't wait.
No. It is very. So the idea of data depth is this: that let me say. So here's a typical one. So suppose that I have a metric space like that, and now I compute E of X is equal to say 1 over times the sum of the distance from X to X prime. So to some p. Mm-hmm. So this is, you're sort of averaging. Oh, thank you. Averaging, the pth power of this, of the distances. So points that are in the middle would have a much smaller value of this function than others. So think of it, if the data set is such that there's sort of a central area and things moving out, the things at high, value here would be. Yeah. And actually, so I don't make you get up and down again. Let's see which
okay, left. This one? No, the other one.
This one.
Right.
Okay. Great. Okay. So here's an example. So this is a simple example for us. This is just a sanity check to see that you could carry this out on so-called Miller-Raven diabetes data set, which is 40-year-old data set or so. From Stanford, it's got five metabolic coordinates and a normalized notion of size. But you can see that the network is the same in every case here. I'm computing the same network each time, but I'm coloring it by different values. So you can see here, I'm coloring it here, and this is sort of the high glucose level group. And then down in here, we've got a group which is all relatively low glucose level because it's colored in blue. On the other hand, here, this is colored by insulin response. And so you can see here that in this case, the network, the insulin response out here is rather, is muted to say the least. It's almost, it's non-existent. But the insulin response down here is very, very high, and here it's kind of a little medium.
What are the XY coordinates here?
Ah, good question. So they're not actually coordinates. The construction that I just showed you produces a network out of the data, right? or a simplicial complex. So these pictures are the result of just doing a graph layout algorithm based on some sort of springs between the connected nodes. So it's not a coordinatization. In fact, the distances here between the points are not really so relevant. The only thing that is kept track of is sort of the local distances, the connectivity aspects of it.
How do you measure distance here?
So in this case, this was, I believe, just a correlation distance back among the... But here you don't measure distances. Here, all you have is sort of the topological output, which is the network and the connections between them. In the original space, though, it was either Euclidean or correlation. I forget which one.
Does each point represent a patient?
Ah, so here's another point. So we were talking before about the fact that some of these networks are so huge and complicated. In fact, I've heard the word hairball used a lot about a lot of the network representations. So the point of this is, remember, what were the nodes that I built? The nodes were gotten like this. It said you take a set you're covering, you take a bin and you cluster it. What that means is that each cluster is a node. So each node represents a set of patients. Okay? So the point is that what you have achieved with this is you've achieved a compression of the original structure. You're saying, look, here I have a node which contains several patients. Here I have another node which contains several patients. They have something in common, and that's what makes us call them sort of close together. So anyway, each node is a collection of patients. Yes?
What's the isolated point out there?
Yeah, good question. I don't know, but it seems to be a point with very, very high insulin response. So it's a singleton. That happens a lot with this. When you produce these networks, you will always get a few singletons that sit off to the side.
That could actually be a patient.
This is very likely a single patient. These nodes definitely can be single patients, but they typically are, yeah. Yes?
A single patient could be spread out between two nodes, right?
Correct. So in other words, whenever you've got nodes that are all connected, then that's correct.
And
yes?
Did you actually tell us what the data was, roughly?
I did. It was the Miller-Raven diabetes set, five metabolic variables and a normalized notion of size. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So what do you learn from this?
Well, so at the moment, I'm using this as a sanity check to see that and so what we're finding is we're saying, look, that there are basically three groups here. There's sort of the roughly the healthy population. There's down here what you might call the pre-diabetic part, where you know the insulin response is high, but but you're not yet getting at a very high glucose level. And then finally here, the so-called overt diabetics.
I'm confused.
The sanity check was just that the geometry corresponds to our known, the known clinical.
So in the three population groups, are you plotting the glucose level or are you plotting the insulin response? Are you plotting both in some combination?
I see, down here.
Yeah.
Ah, good question. No, here what I'm plotting is, I have from the data set, I have characterizations of who sits in each of these three groups. So another thing that I can do is I can color the network by presence of pre-diabetics or presence of overt diabetics. So this one is red out here because the ones that were, that like because these consist exclusively of patients who were classified as overtly diabetic. So it's only these two which are colored by explicit quantities. The other ones are colored by the populations. Here's another test case, and this was some microarray data where there was periodic stuff going on.
Can I ask you, if you go back one?
Yeah.
Something about the, so there's a structure to the graph.
Correct.
Right? Is there something about the structure to the graph that you can extract more information from that tells you why the diabetics are on the upper left hand side of high glucose and no insulin response, right?
Well, let me remind you that the upper left has no meaning here. In other words, we could rotate the whole thing.
Right.
But no, I don't think we don't have particular insights about why that is.
Out of the
what this suggests is, since that there's a movement from healthy to pre-diabetic to overt diabetic, what we're seeing here is that people move out along this way, and then there's a sudden phase change when it moves out to here, because otherwise we'd see them sort of together here, and we don't see that.
Right.
Yeah.
But there is a meaning to the upper left in the sense that upper left points are sort of most links away from upper right points.
Yes, absolutely. I just didn't want to say that there's some coordinates here because we might rotate this thing.
Yeah, sure. But there's still somehow notion that,
yes,
if I understand correctly,
yes,
right, that the links are closer to the whatever threefold vertex in the middle are somehow marginal cases.
Absolutely. No question. And in fact, this can even be made into a metric space because you can count distance by how many hops do you need to go from one place to another. It's kind of a bumpy little metric, but it's,
Is this any different from if you had a five-dimensional space and you have five coordinates and you have samples in that space? This is some kind of a clustering map of those samples, right, by category.
Let me say yes, but the clustering map itself, the idea is to use that to expose categories, as opposed to build the categories in.
So if you did BCA, for example, yeah, you would get clusters that are disjointed.
You might.
Three clusters.
Actually, I'm not so sure you would get three clusters when you do it here. I think we did PCA and we found it was much less evident what was going on here. But yeah. Yes.
Let me pursue this question of distance for a moment. Now, of course, this structure, this graph, is built from considering overlaps and ultimately your, right, you started with a metric.
That's right.
So, if I understand correctly, the statement here would be, or might be, that if I now measure that distance along the links,
yes,
I conceivably arrive at a different measure of distance if I just take a shortcut between the tips of the blue, say, and the red.
Yes.
There, right? So I have, or rather you have, in fact, achieved sort of enhanced or...
Exactly right. So let me say, so here's a construction you can do on a finite metric space, or any metric space. Choose a threshold R, less than the diameter somewhere. I can build a new notion of distance on this called the intrinsic distance with parameter r, which says I trash all the distances bigger than r, and then I draw paths of distances less than r and sort of count them up and take an infimum over those. That is what I would call the intrinsic distance of a given metric space. And oftentimes, it's a much better measure than, right? Did I see another hand up? So this one is just illustrating that, this method, when you do see periodic or recurrent phenomena, it captures it in the form of a loop up here.
Can you explain this more?
Pardon me?
I'm still here. Can you explain this slide more in more details?
So first of all, I don't have good control on what this data exactly was. Okay. In other words, I can't tell you the biology of it. I know that it's related to cell cycle. Uh-huh. But the point is that what you're seeing here is, you're seeing profiles that move across these rows.
This would be very similar, if it's not identical, to a set of genes which are on and off in different times in the cell cycle. So that since it is a cycle, you've gone through three cycles.
Right.
And the genes are being turned on, beta, yellow, or blue,
that's right.
So off.
Yeah, that's right.
And so you're seeing repetitive behavior over three divisions. And this has been seen for many genes at the transcription level or at the protein level.
Right.
Showing this repetitive behavior. But the representation is a two-dimensional graph there is different.
But the point is that represents the different positions that happen as I move through time. And I eventually get back to where I started.
How do I see the splitting of the loop at the center? I can see the period.
Yeah. So what sometimes happens here is that there are some regions, part of the process, that are much more heavily represented. That in this case, it's not sort of happening at uniform speed around here, but you get many, many more points, maybe at this part and at that part. And so what that means is that the algorithm, in this case, I believe used a density filter, something like that. The density filter would chop it up fairly finely there. And so this is sort of a chopping up of this point that's moving out this way. And this is a chopping up of this point. So that's a fairly common thing that you see in this.
And different size points means something.
Right, so different size points is correlated to, in an imprecise way, with the number of points, number of data points in the node. So you can see here, right? Many, many more points here and small numbers here. Okay, so here's another one. This was some work that we did with the Pandey group, folding at home group at Stanford. So this is simulated RNA hairpin folding. And so here what we took was we took the conformations that occurred, conformations of this molecule. It's not a very big molecule. And this was the network that came up. Okay. Now, in looking at a network like that, I would say my eyes are drawn to this feature up here, but I would be perfectly open to the explanation that that is artifact. This is sort of a small feature, and it might be artifact. We don't conclude that this is compelling evidence for it. However, since it's called our attention to it, we can say, look, maybe this is real, and so then you go back to the scientists who are doing this, and we ask them, look, can you see the difference between these different nodes?
And is the lowest one a kinetic trap? If it gets there, then it's stuck?
Yeah, I believe so. Okay. And so the other two here, you can see that there are sort of two different trajectories to the folded state. So again, the math in this case doesn't tell it to you, but it draws your attention to what is a small feature in a large space. And it calls your attention to it, to where you can go back and try to understand, is it feature, is it artifact? In this case, it was feature.
So here, the circle in the upper representation tells you there are two different trajectories for this RNA to fold, right?
That's right.
Either goes up and down.
That's right.
So if I imagine this two trajectories both take multiple steps, right? For example, the first the bottom step take like bottom branch take three steps, and the top also takes three. Then you will have a very similar representation like the cell cycle one. Am I right in thinking that?
Well yes, except here, see, it's different. The cell cycle goes round and round. Mm-hmm. And here, the loop is because you've got a phenomenon that's happening. The thing is the same, and then it splits, and then it merges again.
Yeah, but, I mean, I'm just naively think I see very similar things if you go back to the last slide of the cell cycle. So I'm just trying to see from this picture here. So how can I tell whether this is telling me there's a cycle going on or whether it's just two branches to the same?
I get you. I understand. The answer to that is the fact that you have to study it more. That is to say, you have to actually build in the dynamics. So you would have to then make a way of saying, look, I'm going to take a data point, and I'm going to follow it, if I can, you know, across time as a dynamical system. And if I see that now it's lighting up as I move around here, mm-hmm. I'll see that it's looping around. Whereas in this other one, what I would see is I find a data point that does this. I take another data point that does that. But it requires more. It's not part of this representation.
Okay.
And it's one of the things that we're working hard on, actually, because I believe the dynamics, and frankly, even control systems where you've got control parameters are things that one wants to devise you know, useful representations for. Mm-hmm. So this is work with Arnie and Monica Nicolau at Stanford. This is describing the microarrays coming out of the NKI data set in breast cancer. And so the finding here was that, so you have this group here. There was some normal tissue in this data set. And so some of this, that sits over here. And then you see movement out here. This one here, this flare here corresponds to the so-called basal ER negative sequence, very bad prognosis group. And what happens is you go out here and you hit this little area, everything beyond this area here, every single patient in there survived. And survival is not built in as part of the data. In other words, all that's built in is the the gene expression levels. So what we take from that is that it is, you know, building the geometry like this can call your attention to groups that you wouldn't otherwise find. Right? And in this case, you know, these turn out to be a particularly good group of the ER within the ER positive sequences that have this sort of perfect survival. And if you look at a paper, you'll see that there are genes identified and so forth.
If you didn't know this going in, would you have discovered this?
We would have, because what you do is you build the network. The first thing you do with anything, you build the network, and now you color by percentage of people who survive in the node. So what would happen in this network is this would look like if you're going between, you know, red and blue. This part right here would be deep blue. This part here would be heading into very deep red over here. And then this part is kind of mixed. So yes, that's exactly right.
We didn't know going in
that's right.
This group existed. We did not know. In fact, it was
the ones who never
the CMED group, and in fact, we had figured it out, and we were discussing it when someone published it.
These are not luminals. These are not standard luminals.
No,
they're a subset of luminals,
yeah. And they're the subset that survived even better than the 90% that survived.
Right.
So how do you tell this, given that breast cancer is so genetically heterogeneous?
I'm sorry, what?
What particular genes did you look for, given that...
We didn't look for this. In this case, this was the 1,500 most highly varying genes. So that's what's based on the geometry. And in this case, the filter was this disease-specific genomic analysis, which is something that Monica and collaborators have worked on. But actually, you get the same result if you take a very generic centrality filter. So you get the same flare going out here and the same perfect survival. So it's very, very stable.
The surprise was that this uncovered a heterogeneity we didn't know. We would have known if we had sequence, but we now have the sequence from it, and we now know that they exist as a group. But at the time, we had no idea such a thing existed. And it's explicable as to why they live because of this set of mutations. In other words, it explained a lot. It's a surprise.
So I'm confused because, you know, usually I forget they took 50 tumors, right ER positive, and then 1,700 gene mutations, and only three of them were occurred in 10% or more. So I'm wondering exactly how you did the grouping, given that it's so genetically heterogeneous.
It is heterogeneous, but there are five different mutations which actually occur in about 20% and or more, P53 in about 60%, and down through the list. And then this is about 10 patients out of the total. And
about 8%, about
23%. 23 patients. And they actually had this MYD mutation. And it isn't the mutation that had previously been associated or seen at a high frequency. But it is in this data set, and actually several others, the survivors, essentially the survivors. So it was an unusual thing. I mean, that's what sold me on using new methods of extracting information. Often shows you something you just hadn't seen before.
And how many patients was
this? Total of 272, I believe, and about 20, 22, 24 in this.
So it's about 10%.
So this is basically another way of when you found a classification.
Correct.
So the classification, you're saying that after finding the classification, the thing that defines this set is this particular kind of mutation, CMIDs?
Well, that's one of the things. There are other things that define it.
In that group. The others are more heterogeneous. I mean, the group is pretty heterogeneous.
Yeah, I was going to say, after having found the group, right, can you determine what is the distinguishing characteristic of that group?
So you can. I mean, the software we have for this allows you to sort of explain, you know, you find, for example, the genes whose profiles are most discriminatory between, say, this group and the rest of it, or between this group and this group. So those are all things that you can do using standard statistical methodology once you have the groups. But the point is to sort of find the groups, because searching for groups is obviously too big a problem. So, of course, a standard method for dealing with microarrays is through hierarchical clustering. And so, you know, you can see here that there is sort of a macro decomposition into the two pieces coming from the ER positive and the ER negative. That's something you see, and that's something that you know, no matter how you look at this data, you always see that. But then what you can see is that the group that we've got here is sort of spread out very much through that ER positive group. And in fact, from the hierarchical clustering, it would be very difficult to sort of identify, to say, you know, to look at these guys versus anybody else. The reason for that is the following, that clustering is a one-trick pony. Clustering is something which allows you only the possibility of breaking a space into pieces, and you break it more finely into pieces and so on. But suppose that you have a space which is actually continuous and does not break up into pieces in an obvious way. Then you're going to lose a lot of information, and in fact what you're going to do is you're going to move points apart that really are close together. So that's a problem with clustering schemes, and sort of exhibited here in that what we showed you was quite a coherent group as far as the distance measure went. But it's being spread out here because you've gotten to the point where clustering, the resolution is so high that it becomes meaningless.
That's what you just clustered based on gene expression. Had you clustered using the survival as a phenotype?
Ooh, of course. Yeah, exactly. If we wanted to do
immediately clumped them.
Yeah. No, that of course is true. But we're trying to sort of discover the group.
We would have clumped them together with other survivors.
Yeah, that's
right, but then you could do expression.
Yes,
on top of that.
Here's an example of doing exactly that. So this is a supervised study. This is two different gene expression data sets. Okay, both breast cancer data sets. And so you can see here that what the picture shows is that, well, first of all, here, so these are this core here, this core and this core, they are the ones who survive. So now that I've broken it apart, I'm doing the supervised thing that you suggest now. So everything else here consists of people who died. So, you know, one takeaway here is that the number of ways of dying is more than the number of ways of surviving, perhaps, right? And that's a sort of a rough statement of it. But what you can see also is that there's a very good comparison between the two data sets, even though they were done on different platforms. So they were not sort of directly comparable. There are ways of doing it, but they were not directly comparable. But an immediate quick look at the shapes here says, look, this is these shapes are the same. This one in one study and this one in the other study. Okay. So that sort of goes to my argument about a coordinate-free approach. You see, these things are given in different coordinates, but the same rough shape and the same, you know, heterogeneity of the survival is present in both. Or heterogeneity among the non-survivors, I should say.
What's ESR1?
ESR1, this is the gene, estrogen receptor. Yeah.
The number of ways of dying is more than the number of ways of surviving.
Yeah, that's what the...
Dying is a lonely activity.
What's interesting, though, is here, in each case, you do get some very low ESR1 survivors here and here. There's always a little piece of them, of the survivors who are at the low ESR1 levels. And, you know, it turned out that we could show some things about that. But these, as compared to the ones who died, had higher chemokine levels, so in the chemokine pathway, and I think there was an interleukin pathway as well that was sort of more highly expressed in here than here. Okay. I'm going to have to move across here. Let's see. In fact, let me pass through the rest of these. And we can, if someone wants to see them, I can show them later. But I did want to say a little bit of something about measuring shape. Shape is a really nebulous concept, right? I mean, it's not something doesn't have shape 5 or shape 10 or whatever. You know, as we know, it's very nebulous. It could be a circle, it could be a sphere, it could be a donut. But it turns out that there are ways of making precise certain things that you can measure about shapes. So presence of a loop here is a Betty 1 so-called number. And in fact, there are Betty numbers of all higher dimensions, Betty 1, Betty 2, and so forth. And so you can see that the circle has a Betty 1 of 1 and Betty 2 equals 0, no two-dimensional stuff. Here, Betty 1 equals 0 is not a one-dimensional thing in here, but there's Betty 2 equals 1. And here's a mixed thing with the torus, where Betty 1 equals 2 corresponds to the presence of the loop this way and that way, and also the two-dimensional surface. Okay. So this counts the number of i-dimensional holes. So let me just say, these things, these Betty numbers were sort of developed in sort of a crude way at the beginning of the 20th century. It turned out that there was a fantastically important observation made by Emmy Noether, that these are not just numbers, but in fact they are dimensions of some vector spaces that you can choose. So if you're familiar with the idea of categorification, this was sort of the very first example of categorification. She said, look, it's important to keep track of their structure as vector spaces from the point of view of computing them and also from the point of view of application. So anyway, here the Betty number is the dimension of the vector space. And here's the main thing, though, is that they're not just any old vector spaces. They are assigned functorially. That is to say, a map of spaces assigns a map of linear transformation of vector spaces. And okay, so it turns out that the computation of these homology groups is actually rather simple linear algebra over the fields or integers.
But you have to assume some kind of continuity, assume smoothness of some sort.
Actually, no. It turns out that was thought to be the case in the early 20th century, but around 1940, it was shown that you take any space whatsoever, and you can assign to it homology groups in a factorial way.
You have discrete information of a continuous space. And so how do you know what's inside? You have to assume that at some level, there's particular discrete embeddings, right?
Well, let's see. So when I'm thinking of a space here, I'm thinking simply of, well, let's just think of it as any metric space that you write down.
The data in the form of points.
But it might be, you know, the whole circle, for example, written down, not just data. Okay. Because what this homology does is, if you've got data, if you've got sort of 6 points around a circle, as I've discussed it now, it will produce, you know, nothing because it's 6 points. Yeah. So what I'm going to show you here is how do we get around that and get something that behaves like homology, but for things which are, in a sense, discrete. Okay, so we need to extend it to including point clouds. So this is called persistent homology. And so this has been developed over the last 10 years. But the question is how, that it answers is how to define homology to point clouds sensibly. So let me, so the trouble is finite sets are always discrete. But statisticians knew the answer long before this. And philosophically they knew the answer. And the answer was dendrograms. These statisticians said, look, I have a finite metric space. And you know, and I want to cluster it. So one approach to clustering it is say, choose a threshold and connect any two points which are a distance less than that threshold apart, and I will get a cluster. But then you arrive at the problem, how do you choose that threshold? So, and it, you know, there are some heuristics for that, but you know, basically, no matter what heuristic you choose, you're going to be able to break it with some example.
So, for animal speciation, where these are phylogenetic graphs, yes. Simply whether they can mate or not with productive right. offspring. So then you have a very sharp criterion whether you're going to put them in one group or not.
That's correct. So,
but in general, it is more subjective. What's your
well, it's not as sharp as you think because. You can have an offspring that's sterile.
So I think normally they mean productive offspring.
Yes, I mean you can keep refining it and defining it,
yeah.
But it's not always as simple as you might think.
Well, I should say that the underlying input here, though, it's precisely the finite metric space input. It's a notion of distance. I mean, there are other clustering schemes that take other inputs, but you know, sort of standard single linkage clustering, which this is an example, hierarchical clustering. You know, takes as its input a set and a metric on it. And what it does then is it lays it out like this. It creates a tree out of that information. So here are the data points, and whenever you hit the threshold, which is the distance of those points, you merge them. Mm-hmm. And so what the statisticians found is, they said, look, I don't have to choose a threshold of 0.4. I can actually see the whole profile all at once. Right? So this is a huge step to say, I don't need to choose thresholds, I can build a profile that shows me everything, and so that then I can really work with
it. So if you apply this method to DNA overlap among species, will you get proper phylogenetic trees?
I'll throw the question back to you, actually. I don't know.
But you said that you can now make objective choices. So if you don't have to set any more thresholds.
Correct.
So if I would apply this method to DNA overlap of species, I should be able to get to reconstruct the
model. No, actually, that's not true. I mean, we can talk about that. There is a long literature about that.
Let me say that the point is that, you know, it depends on what you start out with here. I mean, if you take it and you define some notion of similarity, you can build a tree like this, and you would believe that there should be some coherence between the two. But it all depends on how you build your tree and how you build your notion of distance at the beginning.
Yeah, if you hear extinction, the tree is not better. If you hear loops.
Yeah, that's right.
And in evolution, there are loops.
No, I'm more worried because just if you take DNA and you look at overlap, different people come to different conclusions.
No, but
the suggestion was here that there is an abstract but objective criterion which gives you, you don't have to choose a cutoff and you get a reason.
You get a tree, but how do you interpret it?
Just take two genes, right, in the same DNA molecule. Take two genes, build two trees, and they'll be different. Mm-hmm. Yet you've used the same rules to create them, right? And that's just because different genes evolved at different rates.
Come from different places. Yeah.
And they may even come from different places. So it's a little unfair to actually do that as an exercise.
But then what is the meaning of the clustering? If it's objective, then what exactly do I learn if it still will give me different...
You learn something about the genome. Here's the thing about the genome.
You know, the translation here, look, what this does is, this gives you if your goal is to study a space with a distance function, then this gives you an objective view on it, I mean, from your distance function.
Okay.
And, you know, it is what it is. Now, the question I think that you're asking is, does this correspond to sort of our usual phylogenetic trees that we get building them? Yeah. And I don't know the answer to that.
That's right.
Yeah. But it is an objective thing based on the starting point, which is what... But but anyway, the fundamental thing is you don't have to choose thresholds, and you get something that you can still view. And so the question is, what about for homology, which tries to represent loops or other features? Is there a way of getting a profile for it as well so that I don't have to choose any thresholds? So let me show you how that goes. So, So here, I mean, so how to build spaces from finite metric space. We're going to use the covering of the balls by a given radius. So here's a typical example. If I had 6 data points and my distance threshold was this much, I would build this complex here, which would create a hexagon, because these two overlap, and so on. So that says, okay, there is a method here that says just cover it by balls of a given radius and see is there some degree of overlap. Well, but if I chose that my distance is much smaller, then they wouldn't overlap, and I wouldn't build the space. I'd just build the 6 points. And if I chose them much bigger, I would fill it in. And I would get a whole, a whole big simplex, a 6-dimensional thing. So the idea is this, and this is going back to Emmy-Noether's observation, is that what you actually have is you have a whole family of shapes here. Here's the one where the distance is too small. Here's the one where it's just right. And here's the one where it's too big. But now, because of this functoriality observation, if I apply homology to each of these, there's an inclusion of this one into this one into this one. The spaces grow, and so I can actually study the behavior of the vector spaces. So they go, and this is the importance of having the vector spaces and not just the numbers. So you can apply HI, and here's a diagram of vector spaces like this. Now, okay, I have to move more quickly here. Here, so
it didn't slip over 1 hour, it's okay.
Okay, maybe 5-10 minutes, is that it? Yeah, okay. So here's the idea. What you get, so these persistence vector spaces, it turns out, can be classified. Ordinary vector spaces are classified by their dimension. It turns out the persistence vector spaces, which are families of vector spaces with maps relating them, also have a classification. But that classification is in terms of an object called a barcode, which is a collection of intervals. And basically, the interpretation of a given interval is there's a feature that's born at the left-hand endpoint and that then is filled in or dies at the right-hand endpoint. So a barcode like this one, for example, of that metric space up there looks like a circle to us. Again, if we chose our threshold too small, we wouldn't see it. But for a good long range of the parameter values here, there is sort of a signal in terms of this long bar for the presence of a loop. And so this accomplishes what we had wanted. This thing here, this barcode, is the analog to the dendrogram. It is the profile, but for these shapes instead of connected components. And that it measures this thing exactly, exactly correctly. Okay. So just to give you an idea, here's a more realistic example. If I took this complex, so here I have all these data points are where these edges are coming together. And you'll see that if you look at this, the homology here, the one-dimensional homology which measures the loops, you'd like it to say it's 1, that the first betting number is 1 because it's a loop, but you have this problem up here with these guys. And so what you actually find there is that betting 1 equals 3, right? Because you've got this one, but then you've got these two loops up here. So that's a problem, but you might say, actually, you just didn't know how to choose the threshold right. Just bump up the threshold a little bit, and everything will be fine. But if you do that, you'll see that what happens is maybe you then filled in this little area down here. And so now I'll get Betty 1 equals 2. Neither one is the answer that I want. First one has Betty 1 equals 3, second one has Betty 1 equals 2. So how can I characterize the ones that I want? Well, they are the ones that persist across the change of scale. See, because if I look at these two holes, they exist up here, these loops, but they die in moving to the next level. Okay, so they're not persistent. So at the bottom, there's only the big one is the only persistent thing. And then when I go here and find, is this one persistent? No, it did not come from below. So the philosophy of the persistent homology is that you are able to study it as precisely those things which persist across a large scale of that.
But there's another arbitrary question of how large is the scale? embedding number could persist for a long time, or you know, it could be an intermediate scale.
Exactly right. But so the information, I should say, about these things. So of course. You know, there are situations where there are no long bars, where there are bars that maybe you think are large. Again, it's not that you necessarily always want to recover the Betty number. You want to use it in the way that a topologist would and say, look, in this one, I see a long bar. I think I'm going to look for a circle in this data set. And then you have to find it, of course. This is not going to tell you right away, although, again, these things do depend in a precise way on the space, so they are what they are. They are barcodes. In fact, it turns out there are metrics on the spaces of barcodes where you can compare them for different data sets, for example. But so yeah, I don't want to say that, you know, we've got a machine that sort of always tells you whether it's Betty 1, Betty 2. Rather, it's something that can potentially capture something finer, because in fact, data set, it may not, the paradigm for talking about it as a single space may be inaccurate. It may be that there's some structure at one level of resolution and another structure at a higher level of resolution, and so you would reflect that. Yeah.
Just so that I have a better idea, can you give me examples where this would fail? So just just horrible scenarios in which. It is just so that I know,
I'm trying to think of what. Let's see. So,
for example, if there was a little hole in the circle, the circle was quite close by accident.
Here?
Yeah. Suppose lower right, there wasn't
a gap there.
There was a gap there.
Well, then I would. But then, as I enlarge the threshold, as soon as I'm able to jump the gap, I will still have a good range.
So where the holes are comparable to the hole in the middle.
Well, there you go. That's exactly right. But then it's sort of, one could talk about that as failing, but on the other hand, maybe that's saying that's not within the data.
So, Gunnar, suppose you were a really nasty skeptical physicist.
And yes.
Say, normally, as a physicist, you know, either it is clear in the data, you may have to calculate the sigma, that is fine, but it is clear in the data, and you have results. If you need sophisticated analysis,
yes,
with measuring data so that the feature only comes out after a lot of massaging, the physicist biases don't trust it.
Okay.
It's because another person with a different analysis will get a different result. So only things which are robust, which you can see by the eye, is totally clear, should be trusted.
That's what we're saying. So what I'm trying to say is when you have a really long bar,
yeah,
that is robust. That is, you know, you're going to find.
But then I don't need a computer to tell me that.
No, but you might very well.
I'm sorry.
Identifying basically the same structures that your eye is looking at, right?
Yeah.
As in character recognition.
I understand.
You can do it in five dimensions and your eye cannot.
I understand the point. So you go to that, your eye is a very good pattern recognition, but at some point it doesn't do anymore and you want to have the computer do the same thing in higher dimension.
That's right.
But when my colleagues in high energy physics, who also have to deal with large numbers of data, they seem to be very suspicious of any excessively sophisticated data analysis.
Okay, let me. You know, of course.
That's because they believe in religion very much.
Get prejudice. Get the question and continue.
I want to show you an example here. So and I'll try to run through it quickly. So this is what happens when you apply this to a data set that consists of 3x3 patches in natural images, big database of natural images. So actually, natural means actually around town, you know, in the woods, whatever. Actually, it's around Groningen, Holland that all these were taken. But you're taking 3x3 patches, you know, grayscale value, so nine different grayscale coordinates. And you're choosing among those the ones that you get that, first of all, are high variance because most of them are constant, essentially constant. But you're choosing the ones that are high variance, and then among those, you're choosing the high density ones. So let me show you what the barcodes are that come out of that. So. There. So this is so, and by the way, and so I said choosing the densest ones. There's a choice of different density estimators that you can make based on Gaussian kernels. You know, some with a big variance and some with a small variance.
Okay.
So the one with the small the one with the large variance is this one. And so this is what comes out, and it comes out if you subselect 50,000 dense points and compute it. It happens over and over and over again. It looks exactly like this with a few small bars at the beginning and then.
What are you thresholding? You're thresholding space? You're thresholding density of. You're thresholding color?
No. So it's black and white.
Grayscale.
And so the density here is, you know, is this 3x3 patch? Does it have many other 3x3 patches very close to it, very much alike it, you know, in the data set?
It's grayscale
thresholding. Grayscale, yes, great. Well, that's producing the coordinates.
Local grayscale thresholding.
Yeah, but that's producing the coordinates.
Right.
Okay, so it suggests the Betty number equals 1. Okay, that's fine. But actually, there's a relatively simple answer for this. Again, you should use Occam's razor and say, look, Betty 1 equals 1. I believe this should be a circle. And it's a simple answer which you probably could have eyeballed. So if you look at that, you can see basically what it is. It's a linear gradient as if there's an angle going around. But now, suppose that I choose a better or a more localized density estimator with a smaller sigma. Then this is what comes out. And when I say this, I mean, again, if I select, 50,000 points, of this high density here, what I get back is always a bunch of little stuff and 5 bars. Not some large number of bars, but 5 bars. So, all right. So now it's a little tougher to explain. But it turns out that there's this 3-circle model that does it. So here, the black circle is the one I would call a primary circle, which is the one that we already found. And then we've got 2 secondary circles, which don't touch each other, but which hit the black circle in 2 points. And being topologists, we're allowed to move the lines around and put them in the plane. And you can see here that we've got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 loops. So the Betty 1 is equal to 5. And that does indeed turn out to be the answer. Like that. So there are these secondary circles here in the vertical and horizontal directions of high density. These things actually turn out, the Dutch guys who collected this data were actually interested in trying to understand the relationship of this with the visual cortex, in particular with V1. And the interesting thing is that, there are of course cells in V1 that capture this stuff, but it turns out there also are cells which capture this stuff, which capture the line. They're more complex cells. Yeah. But the question is there perhaps a 2-dimensional surface inside which this picture fits? But it's such a what could such a thing?
If you can translate this into gene expression, imagine doing a map.
Yes.
You have a gene expression map.
Yes.
And I'm doing the same thing to look for structure.
Yes.
But the coordinates now, here you have a metric which is uniform.
That's right.
But in real life, you have metrics that are not uniform. So the rate at which you threshold is different in the different coordinates, right?
Well, exactly. So first of all, yes, there's a question of how do you scale the coordinates. And then that, of course, that's an important question. Actually, it's a question that is perhaps best addressed by building a map, not of the samples, but of the genes, as shown inside. Because, so let's imagine a thought experiment here. Supposing that you have a bunch of sensors in a region, but I have some very heavy density sensors at some point, and they're very sparse in other points. So I do a map of those sensors, and I find out that density. Well, if I'm looking then at the profiles coming through those sensors, they're going to be dominated by what's seen with the dense sensors. And so if I'm interested in removing biases like that, that's the first thing that I would go to sort of re-coordinate. But then a second point is that this kind of stuff that I'm showing you here, tends to be more present in things where the metrics are nicer and where the symmetry is better. However, the principle, the way of doing this homology and persistent homology, can be applied in different ways. So, for example, in topology, there are ways where you study the homology of a space at infinity, for example, which in this case would be the homology of things that are far removed from the center. And those things will tend, in the gene expression case, can have homology. So one has to be flexible about what one applies. This is sort of the first proof of concept, so to speak, that this can work on any data set. So yeah, so is there a two-dimensional picture? So it turns out that the Betty numbers that you get, or the barcodes that you get for as you get the two-dimensional approximation, looks like this. So now Betty naught equals one, and this is at a more relaxed level of density. Two coming out here and one coming out here. So Betty naught equals one, Betty one equals two, and Betty two equals one. Turns out there are two-dimensional surfaces which have this profile. One is a torus, and one is a so-called Klein bottle. What I've told you about is what I would call the mod 2 version of this homology. There's actually mod 3 or mod p for any other prime. The other primes will distinguish between those two, and when you perform the calculation for a 3, for example, you find that the space that you get actually indeed is the Klein bottle. And so what I will just show you then is the Klein bottle. I showed you that, what is a pretty picture, you know, of the model, but that pretty picture is not a useful way of working with it mathematically. You can't really do it very effectively. But there is instead the identification space model, which says take a rectangle and make identifications like this. So R to R, S to S, Q to Q there with the twist, and P to P. Notice that if we only did the red identifications, we'd be building a Möbius band, because we'd just be doing a flip. If I do these two, only the greens and not the red, you'd just be building an annulus. And now we're saying, try to do both of them. And what you find when you do both of them is that you will tear the paper, because this space does not fit in three-dimensional space. It'll fit in 4D. So do the circles fit? And the answer is yes, they do. They fit like this, as you can see. These are the two secondary circles. They intersect the primary one in 2 points. Primary circle, this is identified with that, and so on. It goes twice around. Okay. So, and that's how the patches are laid out. Okay, now, so how do you use this information? So Jose Perea, a student of mine, has used this to study texture. So it turns out that when you have texture patches in images, you can sort of take all the patches that you get within that texture, and each one represents a point on this Klein bottle. So you'll have a probability distribution on the Klein bottle, and it turns out the Klein bottle is a nice enough space that you can do Fourier analysis on it and sort of get some numbers out there that allow you to distinguish in some nice databases of textures. But more to the point, maybe, is this, that actually, again, this business with the Klein bottle was sort of demonstrating that you could build something which captures homology and gets you the space back. I'm not so interested, ultimately, in the image processing examples. I'm more interested in the biological ones. And then the sort of things that your question pointed out, you have to modify the things that you do persistence with respect to. So there's lots of options for how you build persistence barcodes in here. But what we've been finding is that, for example, when you take X-ray images, there are ways of taking the shapes and even the textures of tumors and building barcodes that are attached to those, where you can start to distinguish between maybe tumor and hemangioma and other things. So it is quite flexible. I mean, you may not see it from here, but there are lots of ways of attaching these barcodes. And I think I've already run way over my time here, so I'll stop. Yeah?
Question. On the Klein bottle, the two secondary circles that you have, right, they can be continuously deformed into each other.
Correct.
So the fact that you have two there separated, right?
Yeah.
What's the additional information that's
well, the additional information is the density aspect of it. See, so for example, now imagine. So what you're seeing is your Klein bottle here, which has got this primary circle, and then these two. And so what happens is that these things are the heavy density part of it. In fact, the most heavy density occurs right here. Okay? And then the next heavy density comes in here, and finally these guys. And then ultimately it fills in, and you can actually introduce the things at other angles going through. So the information is about, if you like, the development of the topology as I relax my density thresholds. Yeah.
Are there estimates about how when about how this is affected by the signal to noise ratio, because in the literature of manifold learning, I know that people like in the orbit of Nigoyi, and they have developed estimates of what if the noise gets too large, which is very, it's something that happens a lot in biology. You actually cannot go very, you cannot do very much. And in this case, it would be interesting to see when can we really move beyond Betty Zero, which would be hierarchical clustering.
Right, right. How stable is this Betty 1 as you permit noise in it? So let me say a couple of things about that. So indeed, there are papers that talk about when you have extremely rigorous hypotheses on your data, that it lies on a manifold, that it lies in a small neighborhood of a manifold, and you know, and you get estimates of feature size and whatnot, then you know you can say, yes, indeed, I can get the Betty number with high reliability. I think what's required here is sort of the right formalism to talk about, get away from that manifold hypothesis. It's totally unrealistic, in my view, in biological settings. We need to talk about spaces differently and find sort of cruder ways of saying, you know, doing inference. One way to do that, though, is what I was mentioning, which is that the barcodes themselves lie inside a metric space. But you can, you know, you move them a little bit, and so what you can do, for example, is the following. You can say, look, I'm going to take an experiment where I distribute points uniformly in a box, say. And then I ask myself, I perform many experiments, and I produce barcodes from those. You know, do I ever get one that is anything like the one that I would get for a circle? And, you know, what you'll find is you can start doing statistics that way once you've coordinatized the shapes that sit inside this barcode. Now, an additional thing that we've done is we've actually built the actual ring of algebraic functions on that barcode space. So we're sort of moving it more to where one can sort of let machine learning theorists go to town. They don't much like barcodes, but I don't think they would mind the numbers that we produce out of this attached to the shapes.
Can we look quickly over something that intrigued me and may actually stretch what we know, but the question of what neurons we have that recognize the different kinds of shapes,
mm-hmm.
that we readily recognize,
yeah,
the simple shapes, and then as we move into the higher dimensions,
right,
we do have capabilities of recognition which don't click in very
right
quickly. In fact, they probably click in when we know what we're looking for more than when we don't know. But that says something about the organization of our optical capabilities in an interesting way, and I don't know to what degree that's been applied.
People have studied a little bit, but my sense is, so, you know, I think, what we, you know, V1, for example, is what captures these very low-level features.
Right.
And then there's an understanding that, you know, there are these higher levels that come in as V2 and V4 and so on. Some of that, apparently, some of the fact that people haven't studied that apparently comes from the fact that the higher levels are very difficult to measure for purely physiological reasons. That's I don't know that from experience myself, but that's what people have told me. But see, I think that's absolutely the fundamentally interesting question here. And it goes to the point of you want to represent more than just data. You want to represent functions and dynamics, which I think is what's relevant here. You know, in other words, what follows on? Yeah.
Yes. And yeah, that comes, I mean, that's the question of why we have evolved,
yes,
capabilities. And I think it is for dynamical reasons,
right,
that we want to not only process, but process through time.
Recognizing a tiger who's going to jump at you has some survival rules, right? So the fact that we can recognize dynamical sequences makes sense.
But
maybe there's a
question. I probably need one neuron for that.
We use a lot of neurons.
Well, there was a group at MIT, and they were studying something very high up in this sequence. And as part of their paper, they claim to have identified the neuron in particular monkeys that recognize Jennifer Aniston.
Male monkeys or female?
I don't know. Yeah.
Sorry, can I just take this back a little bit? Right. So at some point, you introduced this notion of triangulation or simply
superficial complex. Yeah.
So we're going to tile with balls of increasing size, right? And fine. But then you kind of fast forwarded into a rather global characterization of these sets, right? Looking at the Betti numbers and the cycles and whatnot. But there is some interesting local structure. So as you start tiling, you can ask, do I just get sort of a two-dimensional set or a three-dimensional set? Or so there's something very interesting to be said about local shape of data, which has to do with the dimension of actual data, which is embedded in some ridiculously high dimension typically.
I totally agree. And I mean, let me just, so, you know, within sort of ordinary topology, we have an example called the Cantor set, which, you know, you may know about.
Right.
So this is a set, this example too.
The Hausdorff dimension for fractals.
That's right. So that's a situation where somehow the global structure is not so interesting, but it's the micro stuff that's going on. That's absolutely true here too, and to some extent that gets reflected in the barcodes, because if you imagine that on a Cantor set you were doing a barcode, you know, you have one lot and then a bunch of smaller ones and then a lot of smaller ones. In other words, the degree to which smaller bars are present and how they are organized is of interest in that direction. So that's my point sort of about texture, you know. Somehow, I can't just say a little bit about the local texture of the thing.
I think Lafarge is suggesting that if we use different size bowls, we might come up with different organizations. And you suggest that you only want to look at some invariant properties. It really could be that local, that smaller, you really do have a different dimension, different organization than at larger scale.
I agree. And what I'm saying is you would see that, though. I'm not advocating choosing. I'm saying we supposedly have a notion of distance given to us. But once we do that, we are then going through all the thresholds. Right, so the barcodes can reflect some of that local structure, but it's reflected not in sort of long bar versus short bar, but the distribution of the short bars.
Can I ask a question? I'm just a Dutch farmer, but the real study on acid test for me was when you showed on your collaboration with Arnie the data on the tumor.
Yeah.
There you suggested that you identified with this method two different populations, which you couldn't simply recognize by eye from one of the microchip arrays.
Right.
Is that true?
Yeah.
So if you would just do microchips and you look at them, you don't see these populations.
Well,
you really need this analysis to see them.
Yes. So, and the answer is yes. And the reason is, the proof of that is as follows. The original data set was used by cluster analysis and missed this data set. It had put them in the luminal A group.
Uh-huh.
It had structured them throughout the group so that when you looked at cluster analysis, they didn't come together,
yeah.
Right? Because you weren't using survival data, you're just using microarray data.
But if they were, why didn't they use survival data? It sounds so obvious.
No, what you want to do is use the gene expression data to ask, does it predict survival, and then you look at the survival data.
Ah, okay.
So you want, that's the reason why they've held back survival data.
You don't use survival as an additional correlation.
That's correct, because you don't know survival at the time of diagnosis, but you do know these data at the time of diagnosis, right?
And they did give the separation.
They were predicted by cluster analysis pretty good survival. But pretty good survival meant some people died quickly and some people, a lot more people, women, survived longer. This was a group of pure survivors, right? That's one thing that was stronger than the original data. Secondly, this group had a particular gene expression signature, high MIG, some of which was mutated. And that signature actually, in an inexplicable fashion, made a lot of tumor suppressors and explained the survivals, right? Neither of those two things existed with the first paper or any other reproductions of the paper, right? Which there are five or six. So the analysis extracted a new group, right?
Okay.
It happened to be a particularly good group, but it extracted a new group. It was one of the things, like yourself, it's one of the things that convinced me that hidden in these data sets, doesn't matter whether it's microarray or whether it's mutational profiles or whatever the data set, hidden in this data set is information that we don't yet know how to extract.
Okay.
Right? And And I think the data has done, at least me anyhow, I have to say, is introduced the concept that data has shape. That data has, that there is a shape to this that is informative.
But somehow it's a higher dimensional thing, right. And you make a graph and you don't recognize the correlation.
In some simple sense, a topologist, of course, would come to that conclusion. They're very shape-driven, right? But it is a way of expressing it that seems to me that we've missed as biologists or as physicists even, that we've missed the fact that the organization of data, in the organization itself, is information that tells us something about the biology of the system.
Okay. Let me say a couple of things.
Can you tell us a little bit more about the last point you're making about X-ray image?
Yes.
So is it possible if you look at the X-ray image of tumors?
Yes.
Can you make it into a bunch of circles or something?
Well, so the way you have the tumors and the lesions. Yeah. Sometimes there's more texture to them. It moves up and down, the black and white sort of moves up and down. And so what you do is you use, as your persistence parameter, the intensity function is one thing, and then also the density of other, dark regions or light regions around it. In any case, there's a persistence profile based in part on the intensity function in there, which actually allows you to do a reasonable job. I should say that's work in progress.
Yeah.
Work with a radiologist. Yeah.
So I've seen applications of this to copy number variation data from the Cancer Genome Atlas.
Mm-hmm.
The trouble there is exactly what Sergio said, which is that you can't distinguish the noise from. So if you can't do the homology of, let's say, copy number variation, but mapping it to a set of points, and as a function of R, you calculate Berry number, we see profiles.
Mm-hmm.
And if you apply to different data sets, you get different, slightly different homologies.
Mm-hmm.
It's only because not all the data in a given data set is relevant because of noise.
Right.
You know, I could take a sample set which has copy number variations in some subset of loci, and another sample set has in a different subset, and they have the same disease.
Mm-hmm.
And you would map them with different homologies based on.
Let me make a statement.
How do you distinguish noise from?
Well, right. So of course, there's not a complete answer to that question. I mean, that's a hugely difficult question. However, let me make a point that in the case of this Kleinbottle image processing data, if I had taken all the points, I would not have seen anything. I might have seen seven-dimensional homology because it sits in a seven sphere where it's normalized. But Who cares? It's only after we thresholded down to say, I'm going to study only the most frequently occurring motifs, if you like, the density.
Mm-hmm.
And so that is the sort of thing that I would get as a first cut, because that is sort of more robust outliers.
So you do something like bootstrap analysis to see which ones appear.
Yeah. That's right. Let me say also to the skeptics, in terms of the mapper thing, it's not such a way out idea that you would try to build a representation by simplistic complex. Let me argue it this way. After all, what is clustering? Clustering is you take a space X and you try to find the best zero dimensional representation. Set of points is zero dimensional. If you believe that there are spaces that have some continuous aspect, then maybe what you instead want to try to do is to find a good 1D representation, or 2D. And you'll get more accuracy that way.
I don't at all doubt your methodology and
right.
reasonableness, but
right.
We had a talk here by Eitan Domani,
mm-hmm.
here, who shows that in the presence of strong noise, you can see patterns where there are no patterns. And there was a specific case by this Dutch group from Amsterdam.
Yeah.
And if you look at the constellations, you see patterns where there are no patterns. How do I know when I recognize a pattern when it's real, like we found out in Yucan's case, or where it's simply because I want that to be a pattern and I recognize some high dimensional space?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, so, but the question there is one that, in other words, once you have sort of a putative pattern, you would sort of say, well, suppose that existed. You know, let me try to see what would that mean or what.
You need to go to the biologist to ask if it makes sense.
Of course.
Cancer or to whoever.
Yeah. Of course. In other words, I think it's one shouldn't hope to have a one-step thing, machine that produces knowledge. I mean, I think what one wants to produce is tools that will allow you to iterate.
I have the suspicion that it's exactly what life scientists would like from you.
Of course, wouldn't we all?
Yeah.
And just to finish, also, let me say that one thing is that even from the point of view of quality control, there's a huge problem with quality control. What we have found is that just this first look with some very rudimentary choices of these filters and so on, oftentimes you identify problems in the data that you go back and find.
Colleagues of mine use filters to study neural signals.
Yes.
And depending on what kind of filter you do, a high frequency filter, a low frequency filter, Butterworth filter, you get constantly different data sets. So in other words, the choice of your filter biases your interpretation of the result.
That's true. Right.
And there is no real objective way to analyze these spike data coming from neurons.
No. And in fact, what that goes to is, we've adopted the formula, the idea that our input that we work with is finite metric space. I think what you're pointing out is, one thing that you're pointing out is, actually, there's different choices of metrics on these things.
So we're
providing a way of going from that situation to something interesting. Now, what I would say is, if you've got two different metrics, what this will permit you to do, supposing that I built these network outputs for both of them and saw that they're different, one thing I can then do is I can reach in and sort of select a part of the data set within the one metric and see where does it belong in the other one. So you can actually understand the distinction.
But what I'm actually driving at is there some control system you can do? Can you study reasonable but randomized systems where if you would apply your methods, you can check that you're not producing?
Don't you think that, the physicists have learned a long time ago, I think, that there are several answers from the same data set, and as long as they accurately reproduce the reality of the situation, they are, for the time being, equally valid. And so it's constantly tested where they won't get lost in the 17th decimal point, right? So there are many ways to take the same pieces of data and to create different realities from them by looking at them in different ways. And it's not that one is right and one is wrong, it's that they each are approximating the reality, and the question is which is useful.
The different analysis methods will bias you. For example, if you do frequency filtering on a data sequence, you very likely see periodicities where there are no periodicities. Mm-hmm. It's simply a product of your filter.
So let me jump in here and say, so what I would say then is, look, take the different approaches that you've got to the same data. Produce the networks for all of them, and then attempt to understand, well, what points in here correspond to what points in the other representation. In other words, the transition between the one coordinatization and the other one, will give you insights. It would tell you, it wouldn't just say, oh, I get different things. No, it would tell you, yes, I get different things, and furthermore, they are related in this way. And then you can take better steps towards saying, well, which one is the truth? Which one is the truth that I'm looking for?
Just a follow-up question on the thing where you found the myth gene. In this topological analysis, you did not use survival.
Correct.
In any race.
Correct.
Technical question. You have a metric of choice for the space of persistent outputs. You have a metric of choice for the space of mapper outputs.
We have some rough things like that, and I have a student who's working on some stability things, but it's not nearly as far along, so I wouldn't want to make statements about it.
Yeah, okay.
There are things, though, that you can take certain persistent barcodes you can build out of them and sort of study the stability of that.
Yes. Okay.
For the case of hierarchical clustering, there are like many different ways of choosing the distance between clusters, right? Here, you have only pointed out single linkage, right? But there's like average, I mean, there is like hundreds of times. And you do also analogous of generalizations that can.
So first of all, we can plug in average, complete, all these other linkage things into the clustering within the bins in an African. So absolutely. But what I would say is that no matter what you choose there, you know, it's true that I think practitioners would say they kind of like average linkage or complete linkage better because it produces nicer clusters and so forth, more compact clusters. But it still, nevertheless, has a problem that it still has to break things into pieces. In other words, it is this problem that it still is ultimately a zero-D representation. My feeling is that most data sets aren't best approximated that way and can profitably be looked at by approximating by something slightly bigger.
Can this method suggest an optimal set of features? Is there some minimum? So does it give you like a number? Is 12 is the best, or 12, between 12 and 15?
I don't think, you know. The answer is no. We don't have a number like that. I think what we do have is, again, we have this sort of profile that comes over the point that the change of number of intervals, the resolution change. Maybe out of that one we'll get some numbers and say, look, this involves, this is persistent over a long time. I think that's still also something. I think one wants things like that, and ultimately hope to develop.
Okay. Thank you very, very much.